I call Senate Resources to order. Today is Wednesday, March 26, 2014. So welcome to the committee. Committee members present right now. Vice Chair Senator Dyson is here. Senator French is here. Senator McGuire Faircloth will be tardy. And Senator Bishop and Michiki are on their way as well. But we're going to go ahead and get started because we have a lot to cover. Welcome. Senator Bishop is on. Let the record reflect he is here as well. Recording secretary is Ann Krekelberg. Claire Gross is helping us on the audio. So today we are continuing the Upper Cook Inlet Salmon Dialogue. It was a really good meeting on Monday. Got lots of information. This is informational only. The purpose is to inform the committee members as well as Alaskans who are listening in about the different issues and user groups for our salmon. I have been told that this is a brave thing to do. I believe, honestly, as we saw on Monday, that we can have productive dialogue and stay on the topics and stay above all the fray sometimes. But in any case, welcome. The first group who's going to be leading out today is UCEDA, United Cook Inlet Drift Association. So welcome to Jeff Fox and Eric Hebsha. Thank you. If you guys would introduce yourself for the record so Ann can get your full identity and go ahead and proceed. Oh, also, I wanted to mention since we have six groups, if we could limit the time period to about 20 minutes each. We'll adjourn about 5:30. Great. Go ahead.
My name is Jeff Fox.
My name is Eric Hipsch. I'm the Vice President of United Cook Inlet Drift Association.
Welcome. Go ahead and take us through your PowerPoint.
Thank you, Senator Giesel and committee members. This presentation is by the United Cook Inlet Drift Association. As I just said, my name is Jeff Fox. I'm the former ADF&G biologist. I retired in 2011 after 27 years in several different areas of the state, and most recently as the area management biologist in Cook Inlet. Roland Maul was scheduled to talk to you today, but he is on vacation and could not get back in time with his flight schedules. I guess I should tell you I'm not a member of UCEDA or a commercial fisherman. They just asked me to do this reading it for them and here to explain anything that's in it. In 2013, Northern Economics conservatively valued the Cook Inlet commercial fishing industry's annual contribution to the regional economy at $350 million and 5,000 direct jobs. Cook Inlet provides 5% of the world's sockeye supply, and when managed properly, it could be the fourth largest salmon fishery in the state. This viable and important industry has been here since 1882 and can continue indefinitely. It requires science-based management of salmon for sustained yield and a reliable, predictable regulatory environment. The Board of Fisheries and ADF&G are required by statute in Alaska's Constitution to manage fisheries for sustained yield and maximum benefit. These two requirements are not currently being met by the state of Alaska's management in Cook Inlet or salmon. At the recent Upper Cook Inlet meeting, Board of Fisheries made decisions that compromise ADF&G's ability to manage fisheries and stay within escapement goals. New scientific data was available to inform the board's decision-making process. Decisions were made contrary to that scientific information. The efforts by the board to address the proposals for the fishery were politically motivated without scientific or a factual basis. The board process was influenced by groups pushing for allocative agendas under the guise of conservation. The current Board of Fisheries process is broken. Board members were buried under an avalanche of paper dumped on them within days prior to the meeting and during the two-week meeting. Much of the information was technical. Without a thorough understanding of the interrelationships between the different fisheries, gear types, run timing, historical patterns, and emerging scientific data, the board is simply unable to understand the consequences of their decision. As a result, we end up with management plans that cannot achieve the intended result. At the recent Upper Cook Inlet meeting, the Board of Fisheries also made a decision that compromised ADF&G's ability to manage the fisheries and stay within escapement goals. Nowhere else in Alaska will you find a borough-sponsored sport fishing advocacy group writing commercial fishery management plans. This begs the question why the plans don't work. The Matsu document is full of exaggerations, half-truths, and omissions and insinuations. The conservation issues that exist in the Northern District salmon stocks were not caused by saltwater fisheries and can't be fixed by restricting saltwater fisheries. If declines in the Northern District salmon stocks were due to so-called interception, then effects would be seen across all stocks. But some stocks are doing fine, some stocks are not, because of the problems in rivers, streams, and lakes. For example, in Chilatna Lake, has made its sockeye escapement goal for four of the past 5 years and exceeded the goal in two of those years. Larson Lake met its sockeye escapement goals in four of the past five years. In 2006, Shell Lake had nearly 70,000 sockeye spawning. In 2013, it had less than 25 spawners due to invasive pike, disease, and other problems in the river. The Matsu document says on page 3 that king salmon numbers have dropped to record lows. This is not true. The past summer, almost 90,000 kings were counted in the main stem of the Susitna River upstream of some major king tributaries like the Yenton and Squintna Rivers. Some stocks are doing fine, some stocks are not. Alexander Creek, a tributary of the Susitna, has lost almost all of its king run and 26,000 angler days per year to invasive pike. Several of the other streams designated as king stocks of concern are road accessible and intensively exploited by sport fishery. Six of the seven stocks of concern in the Northern District are king runs that have almost no commercial harvest. Five are also single aerial surveys. ADF&G Commissioner Cora Campbell corroborated this at the Matsu representative presentation to another legislative committee last month on February 18th when she said, "I don't believe the department is assuming commercial harvest pressure as a causal factor in the Chinook declines for any of the runs we have statewide." Nearly a quarter million coho went up the Susitna River last summer. Matsu's publication doesn't mention those numbers, only the problem they have with the returns to the Little Sioux and Jim Creek. They don't mention pollution, habitat damage, poaching problems that they have in those systems. They also don't mention that the Little Sioux was enhanced with hatchery coho for many years. When the enhancement program was suspended in 1996, escapement goals were not changed, and ADF&G's intent was to see if the natural stocks could handle the sport fishing pressure. ADF&G either needs to adjust escapement goals based on current production or reinstate a hatchery stocking program or actually manage the sport fishery in those creeks. A Matsu representative told the legislative committee last month that ADF&G allows overfishing on northern bound stocks of salmon. Again, this is not a true statement. It's not true for sockeye stocks. ADF&G estimates that 35 to 38% of northern bound sockeye stocks are commercially harvested. The commercial harvest rate on Kenai and Kasilok stocks range from 55 to 70%. Normal harvest rates to achieve maximum sustained yield range between 40 and 70%. Neither king nor coho stocks are overfished. About 1% of the northern king stocks are commercially harvested, and only 10% of the upper Cook Inlet coho stocks are commercially caught. This is from a study done in 2003 by Mark Willett of ADF&G. Only 6% of the chum stocks are commercially harvested and only 2% of the pink stocks. The Cook Inlet commercial fishery is underfishing, not overfishing salmon stocks. This does not meet the mandate for sustained yield. Commercial harvest rates for northern stocks are in part due to geography. The Northern District is a virtual conservation zone covering 800 square miles. No other salmon fishery in the state has such a large conservation zone. Only 53 commercial set net permits are fished in the entire Northern District. All of the commercial drift fishery and over 90% of the set netting in Cook Inlet occurs within the Central District. The northern boundary of the Central District is over 40 miles south of the Matsu drainages. Salmon stocks in Cook Inlet are not adapted to northern pike predation. ADF&G has found invasive pike in 135 lakes and streams and rivers in the Matsu. The department has a pike control program in only one of these systems. Because management standards are no longer followed and because of misinformation presented to the board, there's been a gradual erosion of the best management practices. Salmon are anadromous species and as such fall under federal regulation. After the passage of the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 1976, the state of Alaska agreed in an MOU with the National Marine Fisheries Service that it would manage fisheries in Cook Inlet in a manner consistent with MSA. In the mid to late 1990s, the Board of Fish began deviating from MSA. In 2000, the board wrote a new plan, Policy for the Management of Sustainable Salmon Fisheries. The board and ADF&G routinely ignore the standards within the SSFB. After statehood, the Alaska salmon returns puttered along until 1976 when Magnuson-Stevens Act became federal law. The MSA had immediate and dramatic results on salmon resources within the state. Within a few years, the overall commercial harvest of salmon on a statewide basis increased over 200%. In 2000, the state adopted the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Policy. Beginning in 2000, the blue line continues across with the MSA average, while the red line shows the actual average harvest from 2000 to 2013. In the upper graph, you can see a modest benefit gained in the statewide salmon harvest numbers, although some portion of those gains are due to hatchery production of pinks and chums. In Cook Inlet under the SSFP, the average harvest of all species of salmon have declined. On the Cook Inlet chart, the difference between the average harvest under Magnuson and the SSFP, the red and blue lines on the right end of the chart, is a rough measure of the unharvested salmon or surplus salmon. Below the next page, the low Cook Inlet harvest rates of king salmon reflect how they have largely been allocated away from the commercial fisheries in Cook Inlet after the stock started to recover in the mid 1980s. Sockeye salmon stocks across the state benefited from MSA, but in Cook Inlet, sockeye harvest had not maintained that level under the SSFP. In the mid to late 1990s, when the Board of Fisheries and ADF&G stopped complying with their agreement with the National Marine Fisheries Service to manage the fisheries in a consistent manner with MSA, the Cook Inlet harvest decreased by an average of over 700,000 sockeye per year. This lost harvest had an ex-vessel value of between $4 and $10 million per year. Commercial harvest of coho salmon in Cook Inlet had been greatly reduced. Even though 90% of the Cook Inlet coho get back to the rivers, sport fishing harvests only about another 10%, leaving a large harvestable surplus, which you can see reflected in the decreased harvest in the Cook Inlet chart. Commercial harvest of pink salmon in Cook Inlet have been tremendously reduced. The most recent ADF&G study indicated that commercial fishery harvests only 2% of the available stocks, leaving an immense harvestable surplus. On even years, this surplus is in the tens of millions of pounds. The commercial chum salmon harvest has also been tremendously reduced. Commercial fisheries have harvested only 6% of the available stocks, leaving an immense harvestable surplus. Hundreds of thousands of fish and millions of pounds of product go unharvested. This deprives the region and the state of Alaska of the economic benefit of this surplus natural resource. In this graph, the lost coho harvest in the commercial fishery is the difference between the green and red bars. The green bar representing 1977 to 1996, and the red bar 1997 to 2011. If you look at the difference in the red bars, it's not even close to being offset by the increase in the next two pairs of bars, which is the loss, it's just the harvest of coho in the Mansu in the first two, and then in the Kenai Peninsula streams, the next two. This lost harvest is going to hundreds of non-road accessible off-road systems that don't receive much fishing pressure. What we see in the management of Cook Inlet salmon by the Board of Fish and the ADF&G has led to unnecessary reductions in harvest, resulting in significant economic losses and damage to the productive capacity of salmon resource in Cook Inlet. The Mattsu Borough Fish and Wildlife Commission is out of step with the economic and scientific realities of sustainable salmon fisheries management. All user groups of the salmon resource are important to Alaska's economy. The 2008 economic crash and recession demonstrated that we shouldn't put all our eggs in the tourism basket. It's one reason why our constitution and federal fishing policies are designed to support all user groups. As you have heard from the city of Kenai, personal use fisheries are out of control and are approaching maximum capacity. If the Board of Fish was doing its job, we would not have millions of dollars of harvestable surpluses of salmon going to waste. The commercial fishing industry has been funding rehabilitation projects in the Mattsu for many years through Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. We are familiar with the problems and frustrated with the lack of local response. The legislature can respond with administrative changes to the Board of Fisheries, reestablishing science-based management of the Cook Inlet salmon within proven existing standards can provide more fish for all user groups. And finally, if harvesting salmon is so difficult in the Mattsu Borough, why are well over half of the fish released? 66% of the Chinook, 44% of the Coho, 52% of the Sockeye, and nearly 94% of the Pink and Chum stocks or harvests or catches in these areas are released. Only about one-third of the fish are actually retained. Yucita would like to thank you for listening to this program.
Great. Thank you very much, Jeff. Committee members, questions?
I've got a couple.
Very good. Senator Dyson.
Hopefully a couple, three that are related but unrelated to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So always want to ask the question, what should we do? And you said administrative changes to the board process specifically.
There are a lot of options. People have talked for years about a professional board, side boards on the board on just what allocation is, how they have to achieve those allocations. Right now, basically what our presentation is saying is they're restricting a lot of fisheries and putting fish into streams that no one's harvesting to put a few fish in some very accessible streams like Little Sioux.
Yeah, with a little latitude, Madam Chair, yes. I got that, but we need specifics, and we're wary of very specific things that might be changing as the time goes forward, and hard for us to keep up with. So if you've got specific things, I'd enjoy if you could write those down and pass on to it. Now, a related question, everybody holds up Bristol Bay as an ideally managed thing, but that's a river of origin fishery, where it's quite easy to discreetly fish on exact stocks. I understand that in much of Cook Inlet, it's a mixed stock fishery out there where it's very difficult to fish a discreet group of fish that are going by. How do we handle that? Or can that be managed?
Well, I think everyone assumes that there's a problem in Cook Inlet because people are still fighting about fish, and that's not necessarily a problem. It's kind of the way that salmon fisheries go. If you look at Bristol Bay, it's a much different fishery where they fish every tide. I think if you start putting drifters in mouths of rivers and fish every tide, you'd have a real problem.
Okay, if I may, you just said that the fact that it's a mixed stock out there is not a problem, and we shouldn't have to worry about that.
Correct. The way the inlet's structured.
I got it. Okay. All right. You mentioned, if I may,
please,
a couple of things in the freshwater environment, certainly in due species, pike. What do we do about that? And I know in this Big Sioux I've been harping on, should we repair the damage in some way to what beaver have done to the salmon rearing grounds? I'd enjoy your insight on what we should do about the pike beyond what we're already doing, and what, if anything, about beaver damage to rearing grounds.
Well, beavers' biggest problem is they make impassable waterways, especially in the valley. It's a problem because the water gets real hot there. At 17 degrees Celsius, which is probably about 50 plus degrees, salmon die in those temperatures, not enough oxygen in the water. As far as pike...
Wait a minute. Excuse me. What do we do with the beaver? You know, I appreciate the temperature problem. I appreciate the stream distributing. What do we do?
About the only thing you can do is pull the beaver dams out just before winter.
Okay, I got it.
Clean it out.
All right, pike.
Pike, if you don't do something with pike, they're going to continue to spread.
What do we do?
Develop a way to kill them. We've looked into a seismic water gun. We've looked into netting. The only other way that we know thus far is rope known. Pretty expensive and hard to use in those flowing waters. We've accidentally wiped out many species. I think if we tried, we should be able to wipe out one like this. So that would be where I would focus. Is there's something out there that'll take care of it. We just need to find it.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Jeff or Eric? Senator Machicki.
I have one, if you don't mind, Jeff, and good to see you guys. So one of the things I've talked about the last couple of days, it's not an unrealistic expectation for Alaskans to want to catch fish close to home, right? We all agree with that, right? So whether it's true or there's a perception, there are folks in the valley that feel that they don't have the returns they used to have on many streams. We know that that's true on many streams. On some it may be a perception, on some it may be an access issue. You've been in the business for a long time, Jeff. Just if you did a top three, and Senator Dyson sort of asked this question, can we fix it? What would be the top three first steps you would take to fix that problem?
That's kind of tough, but it can be fixed if you think it's broken. I mean, again, just because people are fighting over fish doesn't mean it's broken. As you move into road accessible systems, you're going to have lower bag limits or some other way of reducing fishery harvests in the river. Doesn't matter how many you put in the river, there's still enough pressure in the river that they're going to be harvested. So at some point, you have to have a distinct management regime for each system. Little Sioux probably should have a 1 or 2 fish bag limit, where Deschke could have a 3 or 5 fish bag limit. It all depends on one thing. But then you also have to be ready to actively manage. If you increase harvest ability, you have to be able to close it down rapidly. That's kind of the regime of brown fishery. You have a lot of killing power. You turn it loose when you want to kill fish, and when you don't, it's silent shot. That's kind of the crux of the argument. But you also need to maintain the escapement program we have. In Cook Inlet, we just lost a counter that has been in since the 70s, Crescent River on the west side. It's a $30,000 cost. It's a 150,000 fish system. I should be closer, I guess. It all depends on, just how accurate you want to manage these systems. You have some legal requirements, and you also have a lot of social problems that develop if you don't do it. So.
Great. Thank you. A brief one. Very brief. Chicky, we've got 5 more presenters.
I can ask those with the other presenters. I was going to go with the pike and water temps, but we'll do that later. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Jeff and Eric. The next presenter is Cookland Inlet Aquaculture, Gary Fandry. Welcome, Gary.
Appreciate the opportunity to be before you today to talk about something.
Gary, could you pull that microphone just a squidge closer so Claire doesn't have to
How about that?
All right, great, thanks.
I was wanting to appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to you. What I was wanting to do was to talk a little bit about the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association, something I enjoy very much talking about. I'm the executive director of the Aquaculture Association, a position I've held for since 1996. And it is a program that I'm very proud of. So having the opportunity to be in front of you today means a lot to me. What I wanted to do was to give you a brief idea of what the Aquaculture Association is, some of the projects that we have been involved with, and give you that kind of a description so you know some of the work that we've been doing, particularly up in the Susitna River Valley. The first thing I would mention is that our mission as the Aquaculture Association is to protect self-perpetuating salmon stocks and the habitats on which they depend, rehabilitate self-perpetuating salmon stocks, rehabilitate salmon habitat, and importantly, to maximize the value of the Cook Inlet Common Property Fishery resource by applying science and enhancement technology where appropriate. We are funded primarily by a 2% salmon enhancement tax that is taxed on the commercial fishermen and is allocated back to the Aquaculture Association. That has been the mainstay of our funding source for a number of years. Unfortunately, that funding source varies dramatically because it's tied to what the harvest value is. It has been as low as $176,000 in some years and as high as $2.6 million in other years. As a result of that, we've also looked at funding from other sources, and one of those is cost recovery licensing, where we run hatchery programs and have the ability to harvest some of those fish to help supply the programs that we are operating. We also have some money coming in through grant contracts for fish production for some of the local communities in the lower in the Kenai Peninsula area. And we are also active in pursuing grants to run a very number of different programs and projects. The area that we cover is the Cook Inlet drainage, including the outer peninsula, the outer coast of the Kenai Peninsula, and all the waters that drain into the Cook Inlet. This is approximately equal to the Kenai Peninsula Borough, the Mat-Su Borough, and the city of Anchorage. Our headquarters is in Kenai. We have hatcheries in Anchorage Bowl area, which is a hatchery that is currently not operating. And we have another hatchery at Moose Pass, which is a state facility that we operate under contract. And also one in Lower Cook Inlet across from Homer, which is the Tutka Bay Lagoon Hatchery, which is also a state facility. We are in the process right now of negotiating for another hatchery, which is the Port Graham facility. This facility has not been operating for a number of years, and we are looking at taking that facility over and operating it into the future. We have what we call some secondary programs, secondary sites, which is a weir structure over at Moose, over in Bear Lake and Seward. We have some sites on Calgon Island and a fish ladder down in Lower Cook Inlet on the west side, the Paint River fish ladder that we operate. Our stocking programs are varied. However, most of those stocking programs are located in Lower Cook Inlet. We have one stocking program up in the Susitna, and I will talk about that again a little bit later on in the presentation. Other things that we're operating are flow control structures to assist fish back into their spawning grounds. We are doing a number of monitoring programs, and again, I'll talk about some of those monitoring programs in a little bit more detail. We are also doing some habitat projects, and we work on habitat projects as opportunities exist. We generally try to team up with other organizations to do those. The work in the Susitna that we're doing is also quite varied, and we've been active up there for a number of years. We have been doing a lot of monitoring up there. We do a lot of beaver dam work up there, and we've also been doing some limnology sampling up in those areas. There's been a lot of questions about beaver dams, so I threw a couple of slides in here just to talk specifically about those. What we do in terms of a regular program is we will fly a number of systems, particularly in the Susitna Valley, and look for beaver dams that are blocking fish as they're migrating up to their spawning grounds. In the picture here, this particular dam shows that these beaver dams don't need to be particularly big to be a problem to fish. This dam has about 15 fish impinged on it as they're trying to get over it, caught up in the brush and so forth on there. So what we'll do if we find a dam that's holding fish back or appears to be a problem is we'll land with the helicopter, we'll send a crew out, and we'll cut a notch in that dam. The purpose of cutting that notch in there is to allow a passage for fish to move up. These notches usually only last for 24 to 48 hours, and the beavers will build them back up. And that's a continuing problem that we have to go through. We also recognize that this is not an issue on every creek on every year. It all depends on a number of factors. And earlier I heard some discussion about stream temperatures and so forth. This picture here is on Shell Creek, and these are fish that have actually died behind the beaver dam. They were caught there for too long of a period and water temperatures that were too high. This happened to be an area and a time when we had a lot of sunshine with very little rain. Typically what will happen is if you get the rainfalls at the right time of the year, the water will flood around a beaver dam and fish will find a way up. It doesn't happen all the time, and we think about one every 3 years it becomes a critical issue on some streams in the valley. More recent studies in the Susitna area have been to take a look at some of the escapement goals that have been going on in there and compare that with some historic data. So what we had proposed to do a number of years ago was to do some weir counts at specific lakes in the Susitna and look at those counts and compare them to what the sonar counter was indicating. And what we found out was that the sonar counter was actually undercounting the fish that were going up into the valley. There was actually more fish going up there than we thought. There was also some information that Chilatna Lake and Judd Lake and Larson Lake, which the previous presenters talked about, were some of the major producers up there. We also discovered there were a couple of lakes, Red Shirt Lake and Trapper Lake, that historically had sockeye salmon runs that no longer have fish returning to them. And those lakes had no adults returning or immature fish produced from those lakes when we were up there and looked at them. Some of the lakes that we were looking at were northern pike lakes, and some didn't have northern pikes. And what we saw in there is that the ones with northern pike tended to have reduced production. Our monitoring also was for zooplankton species and in the lakes, because that's the food source, particularly for sockeye salmon. And in, for the most part, there was adequate zooplankton in the lakes, or in other words, adequate food source in those lakes to produce fish. The second part of this was to take a little bit closer look at the northern pike issues up there. What we wanted to do was to try to identify what the pike are doing in a couple of systems to try to determine if there is a way you could economically control pike populations so that you could get fish to coexist in together. So one of the areas that we looked at was Chilatna Lake. We chose Chilatna Lake because this is a system that appears to have something of a stable population of salmon in there, but it also has northern pike. And one of the things we were looking at was habitat areas in there, and it appears that in Chilatna Lake you have good salmon habitat and marginal pike habitat, therefore they coexist. In another lakes we were looking at was Whiskey and Hewitt Lakes. Whiskey and Hewitt Lakes, they seem to be not coexisting very well. And what we're finding in there is we probably have more marginal salmon habitat and a little bit better pike habitat in those systems. One of the things that we were doing there is, two things we were doing there. One of them was to radio tag fish and try to track those fish throughout the year to find out if they're going to be vulnerable to any kind of management or control at any point in their life cycle. In fact, we actually had a crew out earlier this week up on Shell Lake or Whiskey Hewitt Lakes tracking some of the fish that are up there. And the other thing we were looking at was to install a electrical barrier that could be used to help control the movement of some of these fish. It's called the Neptune, and we ran some trials with that information to see if we could come up with any kind of a mechanism by which we could control pike populations. It can be adjusted so that you can allow immature fish to leave a lake system, but it would also direct pike into a side channel which they could be harvested. That's some of the work that we're still working on, and we don't have any clear definition as to exactly how you could use that yet, but we're still playing with that as a toy, I guess, at this point. So the last project I wanted to mention is the Shell Lake project. Shell Lake was one that caught us by surprise. If you look at the graphs here, the one on adult migration, you see that we had almost 70,000 fish escape into that system in 2006. That dropped to $26,000 in 2007 and $2,600 in 2008. At the same time, we were doing smolt migrations on there, and what we were realizing is that the adult migration escapement into the lake was not corresponding with the smolt that were being produced by that system, indicating that there was something going on in the lake that was causing the loss of fish within the lake system on there, and we wanted to do some additional investigations on that. What really got us by concern, however, was on the smolt migrations for 2011. When that showed up, we saw only 17 smolt leave that particular system, indicating that there would probably be no fish returning from that year. So what we decided to do was to go in there in the next return of fish is to collect eggs from some of the fish that return and take those to our Trail Lakes hatchery, incubate them off and rear them to a smolt size and bring them back and release them into the lake after they're a year old. We will be releasing those fish this spring. We have about 70,000 fish that we're planning to release this spring, and they will be going into Shell Lake. We were going to do that again in the following year. Unfortunately, we did not have enough adult fish return in the following year to be able to even secure any eggs. The interesting thing that happened out there, however, is that when we were out there looking at this program, we had the local citizens out there bring to our attention that a lot of the fish that were returning to the lake were actually dying before they had a chance to spawn. They were picking up dead fish along the lakeshore that had a full complement of eggs in their system. That was a little bit of alarming to us. We were able to collect some of those fish when we were collecting eggs, and were able to take those fish and send them to ADF&G pathology for analysis. And one of the things that they found was there was a high prevalence of two parasites in there in the fish. One was Loma, which affects the gills, and the other one is called PKD, which affects the kidneys. And those organisms, those parasites, can both result in the death of the fish. They become a problem when a fish becomes stressed. Stress could be due just from the spawning activity. And we believe that's what was going on there. So what we thought was a northern pike problem in itself turned out to be a little bit more complicated than that, in that there were some other issues that were going on there. And I think that's a real issue to be looking at in any of these programs, is that you've got multiple things that are out there, and we have to be aware of all those things that are happening so that we can make the right choices and the right solutions to any kind of a rehabilitation project or any type of a management decision that goes into place to correct any of these issues. We want to continue with the Northern Pike project. We want to continue with the Shell Lake project. And we're also very much interested in doing a rehabilitation project at Shell, at Red Shirt Lake and Trapper Lakes. And thank you very much for the opportunity, and be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Gary. Questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, you probably said this and I missed it, but talk a little bit about how successful is it getting hatchery-raised fish to restock a drainage system?
Yeah.
We've been running hatchery programs for a number of years and have the procedures down pretty well in terms of being able to collect eggs, bring them into a facility, rear them off, and release them. We can do that fairly easily. The issue we have, particularly with programs like Shell Lake, is that we want to be able to take the same genetic stock and put it back into the lake. So that's really the bottleneck.
Yeah, I got it. But if you did that, are they going to survive, thrive, and is there a track record of them repopulating the drainage with fish raised in, you know, the right genetic stock, but in that drainage to restore the run?
The example I could probably give for you on that would be Chilatna Lake. Back in the early 1990s, there was very few fish returning to Chilatna Lake. We did collect eggs up there, returned them to that system. We returned them as fry, and they did come back and spawn and reproduce. And Chilatna Lake now has a much stabler population.
So. Good. Thank you. And thanks for the work.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop had a question also.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Great presentation. The beaver, have you guys entertained the thought of relocating, live trapping, relocating? Because you're right on the money. That notch is 24 hours and it's done.
We have entertained the thought of going out there with a little more aggressive procedures, dynamite, blowing the dams. There's some problems with that because beaver dams also produces habitat. So you've got to kind of weigh both benefits and risks when you're doing that. In terms of transplanting beavers, I think that would be a short, very short term, longer than notching, but a short term solution because other beavers would soon move back in. And if it's a good habitat, that's why they're there. Other ones will find it and keep expanding.
And just one more follow-up. Yes. On the pike, are any of those pike in any of these lakes that you've, are any of those trophy pike? I mean, I love the pike fish. It's a hoot.
There are some very large pike that come out of these systems. I think one of the interesting things about introducing a species to a system is that you get a very rapid population increase, and you get a top-heavy age structure where you get a lot of large pike. Initially, that is what happens. You can have some really good trophy pike fishing. After a while, when they stabilize, you'll get more of the smaller pike and very few of the larger pike.
Well, I'm just trying to help you get rid of them, that's all. Just let more people know where the big fish are.
I think, Senator Bishop, I've heard people suggest a bounty. Yes. Gary, I had a question. You've presented this information about the research you're doing on diseases and so forth. Does that get passed on to ADF&G or not?
Yes, any of the work that we do try to write a progress report on it every year, and that gets distributed to ADF&G. In addition, on the pathology part of it, we don't have the expertise to do the analysis, so we do have to coordinate with the department, and they're the ones that do it. They're interested, I think, in looking a little bit further into this to see if these parasites are causing a problem in any other system. And we are also interested in doing that and are in the process of putting together some grant applications so we can do some additional monitoring on those.
Great. Yes, Senator McGuire had a question.
Thank you. I appreciate the work. I grew up with a cabin on Shell Lake. I love it. I'm very fond of it, and it's sad to see the numbers down. It's just a great lake for families to grow up on. But to that end, I was thinking about Sucker Lake and how close that is for Alaskans across the way. Have you looked at, just through the years, I've started catching more and more pike, and I don't even know if there are salmon left.
Yeah, I recall we did do some work at Sucker Lake. However, I don't know exactly what it was that we did out there. I know we were out there and did some investigating. Some of my staff did that, and I wasn't directly on the ground there, so I can't really tell you exactly what they found. But Sucker Lake, I think, is one of the lakes that we believe probably has no more salmon returning to it.
Interesting. Any further questions for Gary? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm sorry to comment. I'm harping on an old subject, but I have suggested that trapping people tell me there's not enough money in beaver, mm-hmm. so that we need a bounty system, fish and game to identify the areas where the beaver are a problem, pay a bounty to kill them off, get public service groups, sportsmen's group, and Boy Scouts or whatever to go cut through the dams where it's appropriate. And so far, you know, there may be something happening with that, but that suggestion, I raise a lot of teenagers. I'm used to being ignored, but there's some hope that there'll be a concerted effort where fish, game, and trappers and community service groups can work that problem.
Very good. I don't think there's any other questions. Thank you very much, Gary.
Thanks.
A great presentation. Thank you. Let's see, the next presenter is Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Ricky Geese will be presenting. And we'll get your PowerPoint keyed up there.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association and located in Soldotna. We're a 501c3 nonprofit fishery conservation organization. I've been the executive director since 2004. Today I'm going to start off with a video that we produced, part of a program we called Save Our Kings. And it's a short 5-minute video. It talks about the issues on the Kenai with king salmon conservation and its impacts on the sport fishery there.
Ever. I mean, you just don't.
It was a 67-pound male king. I've got pictures that fish was long as tall as I was.
I mean, you can just totally tell when it's a big fish on the line, how much it pulls on the line, and it's a feeling you can't really describe, because, I don't know, it's unlike any other, catching any other fish, I think.
But I thought I really had it, you know, right where I wanted it, it started coming toward me. And then all of a sudden, you're reeling up and hoping that it doesn't stop. It was fun.
It's not often in life that you go through or have an experience where it takes your breath away. That's what catching a Kenai king was for me.
Right now, we are dealing with historic low abundance, the lowest total returns of king salmon that we've seen over that time period. What's really discouraging to me is the lack of acceptance that there is among particular groups in the fisheries that we're dealing with low levels of abundance.
King fishing is the bread and butter. It's what draws people to the peninsula more than anything else. We've got trout fishing, we've got sockeye fishing, we've got silver fishing. But a lot of times those are secondary things that people do when they can't do their king fishing. But the dream for everyone is to come out here and get their king.
I haven't actually turned a fish in for mountain since, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago. I got a picture of it over there. It's sad. I feel sad for the fishery, but I feel some remorse over the fact that the economy suffers here. I was pretty tired of the drudgery of getting up at 4:30 in the morning and looking forward to a day where I may or may not catch one fish for four people, you know. If I caught two, I was a hero.
You know, the cottages are the ones that suffer first because people come here to fish. They don't come here to play golf, but then they will play golf after they've caught their fish. And that's primarily from about June 1st to July 15th. And we're probably down an average of 30% as a result of the fact that the king salmon's, fishing has been either halted or restricted.
You never know what's going to happen. I mean, you never know if the river's going to be open from one day to the next. You know, I mean, it's frustrating for the guides, it's frustrating for the fishermen, and it's frustrating for the business owners because this is our livelihood.
I think from when we reached our peak in June, what we end up the last couple years, we've dropped in those first 2 months for the first king run almost over 60-65% fewer booked nights.
I think it's a little worrying knowing that when I'm older and when I have kids, just knowing that they won't be able to have that same feeling of catching a king. I really hope that there's still fish around when I'm 40 years old.
There needs to be paired restrictions shared across both the set net and sport fishery, and they need to be reasonable and equitable in manner, and they're not at the current time.
You know, for the life that we have here in South Central Alaska, it's a huge resource for me to not only hang on to my native identity, by having the tools that the sports fishery offers to help me raise my family in a way that maintains our value system. The tools are different. The lessons are the same. The Kenai King is a natural resource. And if you don't protect it, and if you don't cherish it, you're not going to have it anymore.
So that was a video that we produced called Save Our Kenai Kings, and it was prepping up for the 2014 Alaska Board of Fisheries in Upper Cook Inlet. And today's presentation is just to talk about a conservation campaign strategy story. So first I want to talk a little bit about fisheries management in Alaska. The goal of fisheries management in Alaska is sustainability. Both the federal fisheries and the state fisheries have systems put in place. You have probably the most public processes for any type of fisheries management in the world here, both on the federal level and the state level. With the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, National Marine Fisheries Service, they're dealing with annual catch limits. State fisheries management through the Board of Fisheries, ADF&G, they're dealing with escapement goals, specifically with salmon. And they're based on the long-term, having long-term sustainability. You want accountability measures so you can have in-season tracking of what's going on. And when there are times of need, you have a sharing of burden of conservation to prevent overfishing. You know, Alaska commercial fisheries, they account for half the seafood produced in the United States. I think the wholesale values coming out of Alaska anywhere from 3.5 to up to $5 billion. In the sport fisheries, about $1.4 billion. You know, so we're closing in on, you know, somewhere $6 to $7 billion industry for fisheries in the state of Alaska. That type of management, which is based on sustainability, allows certification and marketing of Alaska commercial fisheries as sustainable. And I think that's a really important tool in the marketplace for commercial fisheries in Alaska. There's some fundamental differences between recreational fishing and commercial fish management. One of the basic things in sport fisheries is that we measure effort by angler days. If you're out for an hour or you're out for 8 hours, that's called an angler day. And those are controlled by daily bag limits. In contrast, commercial fisheries measured by metric tons, poundage. How much fish do we catch? How much? What was the ex vessel value for these pounds of fish? What's the price per pound of fish? Second basic difference is that sport fisheries are looking towards maximum sustained production. We want abundance of fish in the fisheries. There's more fish out there, typically at least more angler days. In contrast, commercial fisheries are looking for maximum sustained yield. What's the harvestable surplus we can have over the escapement range that we want so that we can maximize our yield? Sport fisheries are looking for predictable in-season management. And we want daily bag limits that are across the season so that when an angler goes out, doesn't matter when they go out, they know what the limits are. And you can book a trip the first week of July, the last week of July, and there's going to be an open, consistent fishery through that time frame. In contrast with commercial fisheries, you're looking for flexibility in season management. Take, for example, the Cook Inlet salmon fleets. They have regular openers, but they also have emergency openings that allow them to harvest based on in season numbers coming into the river. So you get more towards an MSY production. Then you look at the economics of it. The economics of recreational fisheries are based on large values per fish being generated through multiple sectors of the economy. If you can look at the retail sector, you have tackle shops, rods and reels, boats, motors. You can look at the tourism sector, restaurants, lodges, transportation. And you can also look at the real estate sector. On the Kenai River itself, there's a couple thousand homes. I would hazard to guess half of them are second homes based primarily on the concept of fishing. So in contrast, the economics in a commercial fishery are based on kind of smaller margins on larger numbers of fish. So it's kind of a bulk, and it's going through, from the harvesters to the processors to the wholesalers to the retailers and finally to the end product of the consumer. So those are fundamental differences that we see in Cook Inlet, because you have the state's largest sport fisheries are in Cook Inlet, largest personal use and sport fisheries. In Cook Inlet, fisheries are big business. It's about $1 billion. About $800 million of that through the ADF and G study is generated in the sport and personal use fisheries. A couple hundred million is generated in the commercial fisheries between both the salmon fisheries in Cook Inlet and then also the halibut and other fish that are processed in Cook Inlet. One half of all angler days in the state of Alaska are generated in Upper Cook Inlet. So there's 200,000 residents and non-resident anglers who fish in Cook Inlet, Upper Cook Inlet, each year. The Kenai River is home to the largest sport and personal use fisheries in Alaska. Those include the largest sockeye fisheries, largest coho fisheries, largest king fisheries, and largest personal use fisheries. Alaska is in the top five states in the nation for non-resident angler expenditures. So this is a place where people come to go fishing, and it makes it one of the premier destinations for sport fishing. The Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, a survey was released last year, is the top wildlife refuge in America in per-person expenditures, and a lot of that is just focused on the expenditures generated from sport fishing. In the tourism industry, the average person comes for about 8-9 days, and they spend over that course of that time about $800 in Alaska. If a person comes up sport fishing, a non-resident angler comes up for sport fishing in Alaska, in one day they can spend on average upwards to about $780. So that's the impact of sport fishing in the tourism industry. About 40% of the revenues generated in Alaska from tourism are based on the activity of sport fishing. Now let's focus in on Cook Inlet. Fisheries management here is complex. It's probably one of the most complex fisheries in the world. And it's a fully allocated fishery. You have commercial fisheries. You have, you're hearing about drift and set net fisheries, sport fisheries, guided sport fisheries. There's personal use fisheries, and there's subsistence fisheries here. We have all five species of salmon, kings, reds, silvers, pinks, chums. You have major watersheds on the peninsula, in the Matsu, Anchorage. You also have stocks of concern. About half the stocks of the concern in the state are in Upper Cook Inlet. And you also have the longest Board of Fish meetings in that the Board of Fish deals with. Typically, the average Board of Fish meeting lasts about anywhere from 3 to 5 days. The Upper Cook Inlet meeting lasts for 14 days just to deal with this complexity of these different fisheries. Now, in 2014, you throw on top of that complexity and those long meetings the issue of Alaska king salmon. Ocean productivity is a key issue in low numbers of king salmon in the state of Alaska. King salmon spend up to 85% of their life cycle in the marine environment. National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA researchers consider them to be a marine species. This is a statewide issue. Typically, across the state, we have healthy freshwater habitats. And there seems to be a 40-50-year ocean cycle regime that leads to kind of boom and busts in king salmon production. It seems like when we're very healthy in our production in the 80s and 90s, the top 10 king salmon records were harvested on the Kenai River. That's when Washington, Oregon, and California were having all their ESA listings. Currently, right now, we're in a very down cycle. They're having record returns of king salmon. And this has alternated back and forth through time. Back in the 1940s on the Kenai Peninsula and the fish traps, we were harvesting, 80 to 120,000 kings. Back then we led to kind of a bust. Down in the mid-1960s, the last time the Kenai River was closed to king salmon fishing. It was closed for multiple years. So in 2012, the governor and the legislature authorized $30 million over 5 years to examine causes of king salmon decline. And the federal government in 2012 issued a statewide economic disaster declaration covering the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and Cook Inlet for about $20 million in federal disaster aid that's coming to the state this year. So king salmon conservation, here are the state and federal entities that recognize that this is an issue. The North Council deals with it, NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service, the Secretary of Commerce, the U.S. Congress, Federal Commercial Fisheries. It's, for example, in the Bering Sea, there are king salmon accountability measures as bycatch measures from their fishing cooperatives in the trawl fisheries. On the state level, the Board of Fisheries, the Department of Fish and Game, the Governor's Office, and the Legislature and the Alaska court system all recognize that there are king salmon conservation issues that we're dealing with right now. So how does that king salmon crisis, what's it look like in Upper Cook Inlet? We are having historic low king salmon returns in Cook Inlet. The king salmon management plans that were developed when most of the king salmon plans were developed for Cook Inlet were developed in the 1980s when we had upwards to 80 to 100,000 kings coming back, both the early and late run combined, to the Kenai River. All king runs in Cook Inlet are being impacted. They could be developed fish habitats, undeveloped fish habitats, motorized areas, non-motorized areas, no boats. They can be large runs, medium runs, small runs, wild stocks, and hatchery stocks. We're all seeing a decline on all types of king salmon across Cook Inlet. On the Kenai River itself, major indicators show steep declines in Kenai River king salmon over the last decade. If you look at the late-run kings harvested by sport fishermen have declined by about 80%. Late-run Kenai kings delivered to processors by commercial set netters declined dramatically. Late-run kings caught in the in-river test nets, again, show that same steep decline. So what's at stake? Kenai kings. The Kenai River was voted as the number one sport fishing river in North America a decade ago in 2004 by Field and Stream. We are seeing a loss of that fishery in our lifetime. Hopefully, through conservation measures, we'll stop fishing on these fish for a period of time, and they'll rebound when ocean productivity hopefully turns around. We're trying to, maintain the opportunity for sustainable recreational fisheries for future generations. You heard Jackson there in the video thinking that, when he becomes a father, he wants to have king fishing for his kids. The economy on the peninsula, you heard from business owners there, is really taking a hit. We're seeing a steep decline in the numbers of visitors coming for the king salmon fishery. That impacts guides, it impacts B&Bs, it impacts retail operations, it impacts food vendors. And so what we started off was a campaign goal looking to update the fishery management plans to reflect the low numbers of king salmon. We had a couple of different proposals into the Board of Fisheries. And what they were based upon was just the concept that adequate numbers of Kenai kings must be allowed to spawn, making sure that we have meet our minimum escapement goals, and that we ensure that there's a shared burden of conservation on those groups that harvest king salmon. Over the last decade, Eastside set netters have harvested about 30% more kings than the combined in-river anglers and the dip netters. So Eastside set netters are a major harvester of king salmon. Eastside senators have harvested approximately over 100,000 kings. The in-river sport anglers during that decade have been about 100,000 kings, and personally used dip netters have been about 10,000 kings. So each one of these groups substantially harvest Kenai River kings. What we were looking at, we produced this video as an educational piece to get people to understand the issue and the impacts of the conservation issue and the business impacts. We created a letter writing campaign to allow people to information about this and let their voices be heard at the Board of Fisheries process. We generated about 300 letters from our membership and other people in South Central Alaska who are concerned about this issue. We did tourism industry outreach and got feedback from the tourism industry that the peninsula fishing industry is hurting. We also did outreach through advertising and media relations. So the Board of Fisheries meeting was the first 2 weeks of February. There was, you know, other people said there were 250 proposals. I think there were 12 different committees that were operating during that time frame. It was morning till night testimony and participation by the public. It's a very public-oriented process. And the results of that were being broadcast on social media, both through Twitter and on our Facebook page and stuff, to keep in contact with those folks who are interested in the issue. There were over 50 stories of the Upper Cook Inlet Board of Fish meeting in the media in South Central Alaska. The results of the Board of Fisheries, there are two different king runs on the Kenai River. The minimum escapement goal was not lowered for early run kings. One of the results of that was, instead of lowering the goal to allow fishing opportunity, we said that that's not a long-term solution that we wanted. And we had a proposal in to keep the escapement goal higher than what the minimums were or the new goals that had come out. There's a buffer zone of 1,650 fish included in the late run plan and protections in August. The data shows that as the king returns come, the larger females, fecund females, are coming in the last week of July and into the first couple weeks of August, and there are protections for that. Additionally, there were some in-river fish habitat closures, spawning area closures for the early run, and they put in barbless hook restrictions on when we go to catch and release. They also instituted paired restrictions for commercial, sport, personal use fisheries that was adopted into the King Salmon Management Plan. When the in-river sport fishery goes to no bait, there are restrictions that take place in the commercial fishery and also in the personal use fishery to slow down the harvest of kings. The board also authorized the use of shallower nets in the set net fishery and put additional flexibility in the commercial fisheries management toolbox. Some of those were, instead of having regular fish periods and windows, now the commercial fish manager can use the hours however he wants to spread it out through the week. So ongoing management through the Board of Fisheries. The Board of Fisheries, I think, did a good job of putting additional tools into the toolbox for the department to use. As I said earlier, the early run of Kenai River Kings is now closed. It's the first time it was closed since 1964 when I was born. All major king salmon sport fisheries in Cook Inlet are going to have restrictions and or see closures, and we're just going to have to wait and see how ADF&G manages the late run Kenai River Kings in July. There's a wide latitude of management that they can do. Again, these are complex management systems. You're trying to optimize not only just commercial fisheries in the state, in Cook Inlet, but also the state's largest personal use and sport fisheries. It's an incredible balancing act that we asked Fish and Game and the Board of Fisheries to do in Cook Inlet. Overall, I think this is a positive step in terms of Kenai River King salmon conservation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ricky. Any questions for Ricky? Yes, Senator Dyson.
I'm very impressed with how balanced your report was, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
It would seem to me, with all the tools in place, the sport fishing industry being able to tell visitors who are coming, you know, there'll always be fish every day to be caught, particularly with a lot of sport fishermen or personal use, that makes it really tough for ADF&G to be able to have closures when they're in the escapement. You figured out how to solve that conflict or that cognitive dissonance?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why ADF&G announced the closure of the early run so early this year. They announced it in February so that people could, who had trips booked, if they had come up just for King Salmon in May and June, that they could change their itineraries, or perhaps make some bookings for some other species, go on saltwater trips, flyout trips, maybe go fishing for rainbow trout, you know. So there's enough time now. I think one of the issues last year within the sport fishing community was that the restrictions to go to catch and release were, you know, just about a week before the season started, and that's real difficult to tell clients that, you know.
Thank you.
Great. Short question, Senator Machiki. And the only reason I say that is we have gone over.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
It'll be very short. Well, these are complicated questions, frankly. Mm-hmm. I can't promise that. But here's the question. So, okay, King Slide statewide, we all know that. And we've seen trending in the past. Pacific Northwest got down in some rivers where they're counting single mating pairs right now, really nice, strong returns in a lot of those rivers. So I think what I hear you saying, this was a balanced report. I appreciate that, Ricky. I think what I hear you saying is you're not blaming a group for where we are right now. You just want to ensure that every king salmon gets back to that river so that we minimize the downtime of where we're so challenged. We all want to get back to those healthy runs. Is that
right? Yeah. I do think that this is cyclical, and I think it's important when you have downtimes that on any species that has fluctuations in abundance, I don't think you can have just one management plan. I think there needs to be management plans during times of high abundance and management plans that are more flexible and conservative in their approach during times of low abundance.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Thanks for your presentation. Let's see. The next group to present is the Alaska Salmon Alliance. Arnie Thompson is the executive director.
Madam Chairman.
Welcome.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here at this Upper Cook Inlet Salmon Dialogue. I appreciate the legislature and the committee for having taken the time out of a really busy schedule to schedule this hearing. For the record, my name is Arnie Thompson. I'm executive director of the Alaska Salmon Alliance. I was hired a year ago in January to start up the organization. Prior to doing that, I was executive director of Alaska Crab Coalition and Bering Sea Crab Boat Association for 26 years. And we closed that up in December of 2012. I have provided you with a copy of my testimony, and there's several attachments to that testimony. In addition, you have a copy of the economic analysis that we contracted with Northern Economics out of Anchorage, an economic analysis of Kenai Peninsula salmon and other fisheries. And the important economic statistics were touched on by United Cook Inlet Drifters in their presentation. The Alaska Salmon Alliance was formed in 2011, and we just activated here in January of 2013. It's an Alaska corporation, a 501c6. Trade association representing Kenai Peninsula and Anchorage-based seafood processors, numerous Cook Inlet commercial drift and set net fishermen. Somewhat uniquely, our commercial fishing organization believes that wild Alaska salmon are part of the cultural fabric of our state, they're woven into our past, our present, and our future. As an organization, ASA is focused on public education, promoting the value of scientifically based salmon management to preserve habitats and create predictable harvest for all salmon users in the Cook Inlet region. The ASA promotes long-term sustainability as a source for accurate information about the salmon industry. We advocate for thoughtful, process-oriented allocation of Cook Inlet salmon for the benefit of all Alaska. ASA also supports the concept of a healthy economy, a healthy, diverse economy for the Kenai Peninsula, with a balance of commercial, sport, personal use, and subsistence fisheries. During the past year, the ASA has invested in tens of thousands of dollars in community outreach in the Anchorage Bowl and Matsu Valley, delivering our message about the need for cooperation between all user groups to come together to resolve conflict and seek long-term allocative and sustainable fisheries management programs for the Cook Inlet salmon fisheries. ASA efforts are well known and well documented vis-a-vis community meetings and Chamber of Commerce attendance and sponsorship of programs encouraging collaboration and negotiation. We have documented some of those efforts with attachments. It's It's also noteworthy that ASA spearheaded a presidential collaborative research funding initiative in the Alaska Legislature with the Matsu Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, and Cookland Inlet Aquaculture Association in March of 2013 through a letter to the Alaska Legislature. This effort, as many of you know, resulted in an allocation of over $7 million for migration, genetics, and habitat studies for the Cook Inlet region. We hope for a similar collaboration with these organizations for this session, but as yet it doesn't seem to have materialized. The economic significance of Kenai Peninsula commercial fisheries. ASA has attached a detailed one-page summary of its processor members and the economic significance of peninsula fisheries that we presented to the Board of Fisheries in February. Significant economic statistics have already been touched on by the United Cook Inlet Driftunders' testimony, so I won't go over that again in the interest of saving time. Economic value and participation in sport and personal use in commercial fisheries fluctuate widely from year to year as circumstances change. South Central Alaska needs the social and economic contributions of all users of Cook Inlet salmon, and we must all work together for the long-term sustainability of our salmon resources. In comparing economic reports, it's important to refer to Gunnar Knapp's, quote, comparison of recent sport and commercial fisheries economic studies, which he prepared and published in 2009 for the Cook Inlet Task Force. Knapp advises caution in comparison of economic reports between commercial and sport fish sectors of the industry. Differing methodologies are used by sectors with non-comparable economic value conclusions. In regards to Cook Inlet, Knapp had several interesting conclusions, which I listed in my testimony, and I won't cover all of them, but just a few significant ones. For instance, even if catches and allocations stay the same, economic impacts can change significantly from year to year. Economic impacts aren't necessarily proportional to fish catches. The studies provide relatively little, if any useful, policy guidance on sport commercial allocation issues. The commercial industry, notably, is not viable without a certain threshold level of fishing opportunities and regular openings. Economic arguments for changes in allocation should be based on analysis and clear thinking about the specific expected economic effects of the specific proposed policy change. And finally, a major economic concern of the Alaska Salmon Alliance is the anti-setnetter ballot initiative, an issue that was covered quite adequately in testimony on Monday by the Kenai Peninsula Fisheries Association. We agree with the association that if this initiative is allowed to go forward, that it will immediately eliminate 500 Setnap family businesses, most of whom reside in the Cook Inlet region. It would also severely disrupt processor efforts for orderly and efficient production. Legislative involvement at the Cook Inlet Board of Fisheries meeting, February 2014. Without a doubt, we've seen a sea change in recent years in how certain influential people have interacted with the Board of Fisheries and ADF&G. In the past, fisheries management was a job that was best left to the professionals. That means biologists who are trained and mentored in ever-changing dynamic field of fisheries sciences. It takes years of involvement in the fisheries and thorough understanding of interrelationships between different fisheries, gear types, run timing, historical patterns, and emerging scientific data to make informed and intelligent decisions. Policies of allowing trained professionals to comment on scientific aspects of proposals, even allocated proposals that are couched in escapement goal proposals, needs to be encouraged. Professional biologists need to be able to fulfill their job requirements so Alaska fisheries management can continue to be the model for the future. Political interference was apparent at the 2014 Cook Inlet Board of Fish meeting, and decisions were made that did not incorporate the best science, and the public process was pushed aside for expediency. One of the legislative representatives from the Kenai area filed a letter of concern with the Board of Fisheries about this issue. As a direct result of this political influence, dramatic new restrictions were placed on the Cook Inlet commercial drift fleets, both the drift fleet and the setnetter fleets in the harvest of salmon. I will not go into any detail on those new regulations, but they really had quite an effect. There were many reports presented to the Board of Fisheries at the 2014 Cook Inlet meeting. ADF&G presented several staff reports, and individuals and user groups used ADF&G data in compiling their reports. In contrast, the report from the Matsu Borough Fish and Wildlife Commission called Juno, We Have a Problem, is simply a case study in Alaska fisheries ideology, and a critique has already been presented to you about that proposal. As such, it characterizes the Matsu Borough culture of fishery science and management. It is a conglomeration of assertions, theories, and claims that hint at a political, social, and economic program that will hopefully lead to getting more fish in the Northern District rivers. In actuality, its acceptance can set a precedent that will lead to the demise of science-based management in the Board of Fisheries. Specific Board of Fisheries process issues of concern leading to a politicized process. Something that's already been touched on quite well by Rick Cook, the city manager for Kenai, for the city of Kenai, and the Kenai Peninsula Fishing Association, the issue of board-generated proposals and the difficulty they present, as there's really no allowance for ADF&G to analyze these proposals that are produced on the spot at the Board of Fish, and there's also no opportunity for public comment. Next issue, the need for a pre-screening process that can deal with the problem of over 200 Cook Inlet proposals. Too many proposals create, as we have heard, too much of a workload on not only the ADF&G staff, but also Board of Fish members who have to read thousands of pages of documents. Therefore, the ADF&G and the Board of Fish could consider a pre-screening system that could be developed to utilize some combination of ADF&G staff to prioritize a meaningful list of proposals to be dealt with in the normal cycle, with a goal to reduce the number of proposals to a pre-established limit for the issues that could be set by the Board of Fish. Another important issue that we think could be entertained is the need for a collaborative and inclusive public process to develop long-term allocative and management solutions for Cook Inlet. There's a need to consider developing an informal stakeholder process and discussion to identify core problems, a reasonable range of proposed solutions, and credible sector representatives that can eventually serve on a stakeholder committee to seek long-term allocative and management solutions. Teleconference meetings could be organized outside the normal Board of Fish cycle. The unofficial process can be funded primarily at the expense of stakeholders, who would also set a schedule for meetings. Once a critical mass of stakeholders have come to the table and established some clear alternatives and demonstrated the desire to continue, the Board of Fish can make a preliminary decision to sanction the process and schedule it for preliminary review. This kind of a process has been successful in other fisheries in Alaska. Finally, a need for Board of Fisheries to take action to protect in-river habitat. We heard quite a bit about that from Dwight Kramer on Monday of the Kenai Area Fisheries Coalition, who submitted some 10 proposals. These habitat-related proposals recommended seasonal spawning bed closures to protect Kenai king salmon. The Alaska Salmon Alliance strongly supported some of those proposals, particularly proposal number 219, which was also supported by the U.S. Department of Interior Fish and Wildlife Service, and this would have called for a collaboration with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to try to work out some reasonable spawning bed closures. Finally, some conclusions, economic and resource sustainability, threats from a politicized process. The powerful economic engine of the commercial sport and personal use fisheries of Cook Inlet runs on a renewable resource and requires only two things: science-based management of salmon for sustained yield, and a reliable and predictable regulatory environment that allows for an orderly harvestable surplus of salmon. Current management plans and politics are increasingly placing salmon runs at risk and setting up unrealistic expectations for some user groups. As long as there are sufficient salmon returns, the ASA believes that you can provide for a healthy commercial fishery, there will always be reasonable opportunity and sufficient numbers of salmon to meet the needs of in-river harvesters and escapement goals. If salmon returns decline, eventually all users face restrictions or even closure to meet escapement goals. Continued politicization will be the death knell of sustainable fisheries management and threatens the state of Alaska's fisheries management reputation as a model for fisheries management in the U.S. That concludes my remarks, Madam Chairman. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you, Arnie. Questions for Arnie? All right, seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's see, our next presenter is from the United Fishermen of Alaska. Julianne Curry is the Executive Director. Welcome. It's good to have at least one fisherwoman each day. We had three on Monday. So, welcome, Julianne.
So there's a lot of great pictures in this presentation, and it's not going to hurt my feelings if you decide to turn around and watch the PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, we can see it right there. We have a screen, a little screen right there.
Perfect.
So we are watching, besides the pictures we have printed. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chairman Giesel and members of the Senate Resources Committee. My name is Julianne Curry, and I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. We were asked to give a brief presentation on Alaska's commercial fishing industry today. UFA is the statewide commercial fishing organization comprised of 36 member organizations, four at-large members, and over 475 individuals and businesses and processors. Our members operate commercial fishing businesses throughout the state of Alaska and in its offshore federal waters. Many UFA members are also active personal use and subsistence fishermen. Throughout this presentation, the economics presented are primary dollar values and do not include the multiplier effects that are typically included in economic reports. There is very little data for the seafood industry that includes multiplier effects. This slide illustrates commercial fishing ex-vessel values of species statewide harvested in Alaska. This is the price paid to fishermen at the dock and does not include the dollar value paid to the processor once that seafood is sold. Average ex-vessel value between 2008 and 2012, groundfish has the highest value at $911 million. Salmon comes in at number two at $544 million. Shellfish at $259 million, herring at $91.4 million, halibut at $38.4 million, and our dive fisheries come in at $2.6 million. Commercial fishing harvest volume, groundfish comes in at number one again with 4 billion pounds. The majority is Alaska pollock caught in federal waters. Salmon comes in at number two at over 790 million pounds, most of which is pink salmon. Shellfish comes in at 92.6 million pounds, herring at 91 million pounds, halibut at 38 million pounds, and our dive fisheries come in at 2.6 million pounds. There are over 200 different active commercial fisheries in Alaska. The following slides highlight some of the major species harvested. We harvest five different species of salmon with four different gear types, including seine, gillnet, setnet, and troll, which is a hook and line fishery. The five species of salmon are king, which are also known as chinook, sockeye, which are also known as reds, most of them come from Bristol Bay, cohos, which are known as silvers, keta, which are known as chums, and pinks, which are affectionately known as humpies. Pink salmon comprise the majority of the volume of salmon harvested by the commercial sector. Of the groundfish and whitefish fisheries, we have halibut, pollock, cod, sablefish, also known as black cod, and many other species. In the crab and shellfish fisheries, we have king crab, Dungeness crab, snow crab, scallops, prawn, and other species. Alaska also has a number of herring fisheries that contribute significant volume, and we also have a very unique dive fishery. Fishing is Alaska. Alaska's commercial, sport, personal use, and subsistence fisheries are all a vital component of our economy and of our way of life. All of these fisheries provide Alaskans with access to Alaska's fisheries resources. Subsistence and recreational fisheries bring Alaskans to the fish, while commercial fisheries bring the fish to Alaskans. The seafood industry is fully dependent on sustainable fisheries for their livelihood and for the success of their children. The seafood industry is Alaska's largest private sector employer, creating over 63,000 direct jobs throughout the state. Alaska's seafood industry contributes over $130 million in direct tax revenue to the general fund and also to local municipalities. In Alaska, 1 in 8 workers earn all or part of their annual income directly from the seafood industry. Estimated earnings by Alaska-based permit holders, which does not include crew or processors, is $681 million. Direct jobs created by the seafood industry in Alaska produce a wholesale value of $4.6 billion worth of wild, sustainable seafood and result in an estimated $1.7 billion in labor income. Commercial fishing permit holders and crew members reside in 217 out of the 355 incorporated cities and census-designated places in Alaska. These are people who live in our communities and contribute significantly to our economy. Virtually every business in Alaska benefits from commercial fishing dollars through support of dozens of other supports businesses, such as hardware and marine suppliers, fuel, air and water travel, shipping, restaurants, supermarkets, boat builders, shipyards, accountants, scientists, educators, and administrators. You've all seen our United Fishermen of Alaska commercial fishing fact sheets, which are compiled by our executive administrator, Mark Vinsel. For 2012, of active permit holders, 74% are Alaskan residents, and there are over 10,500 full-year resident crew member licenses sold. For the communities in the Mat-Su Borough, there are 221 active permit holders, 446 full-year crew member licenses sold, and Mat-Su-based fishermen landed over $16 million worth of seafood based on ex-vessel prices. For the communities in the Anchorage Municipality, 499 permit holders fished in 2012, and over 1,200 full-year crew licenses were purchased, which ranks Anchorage at the highest total fishing participation in the state. There are over 470 Alaska-based processing jobs and over $6.8 million in Alaska-based processing wages. Ex-vessel value of seafood landed in Anchorage was $10.2 million. For the communities in the Kenai Peninsula Borough, over 1,000 permit holders fished in 2012, and over 1,600 full-year crew licenses were purchased. There are 893 Alaska resident processing jobs earning $7.2 million per year in wages. Ex-vessel income by Kenai Peninsula-based resident permit holders is over $120 million. Thank you, Chairman Giesel and members of the Senate Resources Committee. I'm happy to answer any questions, and anything that I cannot answer today, I would be happy to.
Great. Thank you very much, Julianne. Questions for Julianne? Yes, Senator Machicki.
I've got one. And Julianne, through the chair, refreshing presentation for a specific reason. You talk about the combined value. Some folks talk about sport value specifically. Some folks talk about the commercial value specifically. And reality of it is, in this economy, we can't sacrifice either side. And I like discussing, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars on both sides annually for value to Alaskans. So I appreciate that. I hope UFA will stay focused on it as well as the other groups. When I hear one side being more important because a particular year, according to their study, they say it has more value, to me it demonstrates a complete misunderstanding of the Alaskan economy. We have to support both sides, make sure they both survive. So refreshing. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Other questions for Julianne? I'll just mention that in the packet. I'm sorry, did you have a question, Senator Bishop?
When you're done.
Okay. You actually break it down by community, and that's really useful, too. I know you come around and quiz us how many fishing licenses in our district, et cetera. You provide us with that information, so thank you. Senator Bishop, a question?
I'd just like to thank you and your organization for the jobs that they create for Alaskans, especially those entry-level jobs on the front end and in the processors, and I really appreciate your efforts in reaching out to the interior of Alaska and other parts of Alaska to find people, because those are good entry-level jobs and they're career builders. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Very good.
And Chairman Giesel?
Yes.
If you don't mind, you've got couple of pictures up there behind you. My dad can't listen in today. He's down there on the bottom left-hand side because he's currently participating in the Sitka herring fishery. And over on the right-hand side, that's actually my mom, and she is listening in today, so I just wanted to say hi.
Oh, great, great. All right. Thank you very much, Julia.
Thank you.
All right. Our last presenter today is the Kenai Watershed Forum. This is not a fishery user group, but certainly has impact on the Kenai. Robert Ruffner, welcome.
Good evening. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come down and chat with you guys. I will do my best at the end of the day here to make this entertaining. And there's some of this is going to be a little repetitive, so I'm going to skip through some of it and try to maybe put a little bit different spin on some of the stuff that you've already heard today. So I will do my best to do that. For the record, my name is Robert Ruffner. I'm the executive director of the Kenai Watershed Forum. What I'd like to talk about today in this time is I want to tell you who we are, how we're different. Senator Geisel already alluded to that. Some of the key habitat concerns from what we really do know, some of the key habitat concerns that our organization shares about things that we don't know but we think we really ought to be looking at a little bit more closely. I'm going to do my best to deliver a couple of rather difficult messages to deliver in this discussion. And last, I'll try to summarize with some recommendations or at least some thoughts that I would like you guys to leave with. So our organization was founded incorporated in 1997. We have a 9-member diverse board of directors. So this is key to our organization is that we try to place people from the different user groups on our board. We also try to make sure that we have some industry representation that's outside of the fishery industry so that we can have some corporate think, if you will. And that's been really important to us and has helped us through our maturation as an organization. We cover the entire Kenai Peninsula plus, and the reason I put the plus on there is because we have recently been the work that we've done on the Kenai Peninsula, the Matsu Borough has actually contracted with us to take some of our mapping skills and remote sensing work that we do in our research avenues north to give them some of the same information that we have on the Kenai Peninsula. We're completely non-allocated with respect to fish. So our organization is really founded on the points that we want the fish to come back. We want them to come back and as abundantly as we can to support all of the different user groups. We have two offices. Our main office is in Soldotna, excuse me, and we have one staff person down in Homer. So we have 10 employees altogether. We do our work through three different programs. Our major programs are education, research, and restoration. Budgets for our organization, just to give you a scale of how we operate, in recent years has been between $1 and $3 million a year. And the biggest variable that accounts for that is the type of restoration projects that we tackle. So when we go out and select projects that we want to work on restoration, some of these are, you know, relatively inexpensive. Some of them are, you know, north of a couple $1 million. So that's the type of work and the scale of our organization. So now I want to jump into these habitat concerns, and what I want to talk about is those things that most people agree with when we convene scientists and have them sit around, help us do our strategic thinking on what we should be concerned about with habitat. These are the things that people have recently come up in part of the Kenai Peninsula Fish Habitat Partnership. And so, well, we've already heard a lot about pike, but invasive species. And invasive species are not just limited to pike, but there are also some plants that have some negative impacts on salmon. And one of those things that's recently made the news and there's been some action on is Elodea. So those types of things are out there. They're our number one concern. These priorities are in order. And trust me, this was a very difficult thing to do to get 20 different scientists that all wear different hats to sit around the room and agree on what the most important things are that we really need to be worried about going forward into the future. Second thing up there is warming water and changing hydrologic conditions. So you heard a little bit about that from Mr. Fandry and the Aquaculture Association in that we know that water is warming and we see fish kills as a result of it, and we know the trend is that things are warming up. We've also gone through some drought years where we have just less water available. And both of those things have significant impacts on our fisheries. Roads and culverts, I think everybody generally understands that roads can act as dams if the culverts are not in place, so I'll talk a little bit more about that. And lastly, the nearshore environment. So these are riparian areas is the fancy word for this, but these are those areas that are really next to the lakes and streams that have a unique vegetation type that are really connected with that river and support those fish. Number one priority concern that we have, and I don't know if you can see it on the small screen, but on the big screen you can definitely see the Kenai Peninsula group selected invasive species for a reason. And here's my different twist on this, because you've already heard a lot of it. You've seen the same picture that we got from Fishing Game about a belly full of salmon that a pike has. When you look at this map, you can see that the Mat-Su area has large areas of pike-infested waters, and they have made a significant dent in the population of multiple species of salmon into our north from where I am. When you look at our area, there's not a lot of red up there, but there's some yellow. And that yellow is areas where the pike could come in if we're not careful. And we've already got a little bit of pike issues on the Kenai Peninsula. We need to make absolutely sure that when an invasive species comes into an area that can have a negative impact on something that's so important to our economy like fish, that we nip those things in the bud. We should not be looking at a map that's all red in the Mat-Su Valley. We should have dealt with this 15, 20 years ago when it first emerged. We're lucky on the Kenai Peninsula that some of these pike have not spread. My office is about 200 feet away from one of the waters that's connected to the Kenai River that has pike in it. And I hope that Fish and Game is successful in their eradication techniques to getting rid of the pike on the peninsula so we don't come back here in 15 or 20 years and show you a map that has a bunch of red on it for pike on the Kenai Peninsula. So if there's a key message in pike or any other invasive species, the state needs to have a much quicker and a rapid response mechanism in place to deal with invasive species. Because what we're looking at in the Mat-Su now, we can't fix this. We're not going to be able to eradicate pike in the Mat-Su. They're too widespread and too much out there. So it's going to be a continuing operating cost to do the best we can to keep salmon productive in the areas that are most productive. It's going to have to keep spending money from now on to control pike up there. And I don't want to see us do that anywhere else. I'm going to go a little quick on the culverts. I've got some pictures here of some culverts that we fixed. This is a little bit of a success story for the Kenai Peninsula. About 15 years ago, when we looked around, there were a whole bunch of these pipes that were blocking fish, and they blocked the juvenile fish that you can see in the picture, and that's a juvenile, I think that's a juvenile king, but it could be a coho. They're kind of hard to tell apart when they're young and in a plastic bag like this. Juvenile pike can't move around, juvenile salmon cannot move around and get to the habitats they need when they have culverts that look like this. So one of the things that we've done with our organization, with lots of other partners and lots of sources of funding over the past 15 years, is to fix most of the culverts that are causing the problems on the Kenai Peninsula. We're almost done. We can almost scratch this off in the Kenai Peninsula. Mat-Su Borough has a ways to go yet. They had more roads up there. They got a little bit later start on trying to deal with this. So even though I'm going to advocate for an area that's not my area where I work, if we can send some more money and keep some flowing so that they can work on their secondary roads for the borough, that would be great. On the Kenai Peninsula, the ones that are left that are still blocking significant habitat for Chinook salmon are on our major roads. So they're on the DOT, the Sterling Highway roads. It's very disruptive to work on these. I'm going to do my best to work with the department to get rid of these last five or six barriers that we have on the Kenai Peninsula, but it's not cheap. Cutting a major highway is $5 million, is about as cheap as we can do it to start working on these things. So we're going to work to try to get those last ones knocked out. I'm going to switch gears now and talk about the priority concerns from our organization. So now I'm not representing any other organization or anybody else's thoughts. This is our own organization's thoughts on things that we should be trying to learn about that we just don't know enough about. And this is pretty generic. Everything Kenai River and tributary Chinook salmon. So low abundance, we got it. I could not agree more. We're in a time of low abundance, but it's also the time when stocks are most vulnerable to everything else that can happen. So we need to be very careful about our management activities when we're in times of low abundance. Now, I've highlighted particularly juvenile behavior because, as you've heard, Kenai River is a very intensive fishery. We've got an intense bank fishery. We've got an intense boat fishery. There's lots of stuff going on out there. It generates tons of economic activity. Lots of people on good years go home happy. It's good for us. What we don't know enough about is all that activity that's going on out there. How might it be affecting our juvenile fish? We don't know enough about juvenile fish. So when all this activity is going on out there for a very short period of time, is it having an adverse effect? We just don't know. We've got some indicators. We've had some water quality issues that have come up that indicate that, hey, we're not meeting standards that are set by the state. Makes us nervous. So that those two things are linked together on these bullet points, the physical disturbance from the in-water intensive in-river freshwater fisheries. Last is I use the fancy word, I'll use it again, riparian buffers. It used to be that the Department of Fish and Game was keeping a pretty close eye on how development was occurring near the river, and in the past 5 or 6 years, it's just been hard for the Sport Fish Division to keep up with this because they're the entity that's responsible for doing these studies and reports, and it's hard for them to have enough capacity, resources to continue those types of studies, but we think they're really important. We should keep looking at it. Difficult message number one. Who's in charge and accountable for these issues? So Pike, we know that right now that, bless their hearts, the Sport Fish Division has assumed a statewide region that deals with habitat. But it got away from us. It got away from us in the Mat-Su. We've had reed canary grass get away from us on the Kenai Peninsula, which is one of these plants that can have a negative impact. So I guess if I can deliver a difficult message here for those things, we know that somebody's waving their arms saying, yeah, we're responsible, we'll do this, but we're failing at some of those. And so it's a difficult message to deliver because I want to give them all the support and give them the encouragement to get the work done, and that's where I think that they need help in that area. Secondly, we've had concerns about the Board of Fish and what they do and what they don't do. One thing that I would encourage you to do is there's an 8-page document that's called the Alaska Sustainable Salmon Policy. And it's a regulation that every time they pass or they take up an action, they ask a staff member, are we consistent with the Alaska Sustainable Salmon Policy? Read that document. There's no way that they can do that without DEC, who's responsible for water quality, and DNR, is responsible for managing the state parks like the Kenai River, to not be there and be a very active participant in that and be able to check that box and say, for the habitat components, we are compliant with our sustainable salmon policy. It's a very good document. I think we need to pay more attention to it and follow it more closely. Difficult message number two. I only wanted to do two of these. In my opinion, in our organization's opinions, the ones that really are not being met and are really failing to get the attention they need are the ones that cut across multiple agencies. So I'll just give you an example. So previously we had some intensive fishing concerns with the motorboat traffic, and we identified gasoline going into the river from motorboats. We knew this was a problem. We knew it was exceeding state water quality standards. It turned out that it was, you know, several hundred gallons a day going into the river. Everybody knew that we needed to address that. Nobody was really, really willing to step up and say, yes, I'll do it. Instead, we had a lot of this. Let's point to this agency, let's point to that agency, let's point to that agency. We went to the Board of Fish, and I think it's 2005 maybe that we did that, presented it there. Same kind of exercise happened at that meeting. The difficult message here is that I wish the state would step up when we have issues like this, and so we don't have to engage the federal government. Nobody wants us to engage the federal government, but this is proof. I mean, I saw this happen in that it required us to have EPA write us a letter saying you're on the impaired water body list, so you're on a bad list, shame on you, clean up your act. And as soon as that happened, the finger pointing stopped and people got busy and we fixed that problem. So we no longer have that concern with hydrocarbons in the Kenai River. We should not have gotten to the point where we required them to put us on the naughty list. So if there's a way that any of you in your legislative abilities can help us pay more attention to that so we don't do that kind of stuff, it'd be very much appreciated and very welcomed. Last slide. And again, I'm going to point to the Sport Fish Division, because they're the entity that has a statewide region that is really concerned with research and habitat research and managing like the invasive species and culverts and these things. We need more capacity in that department somewhere. I don't know if it's supposed to be in Sport Fish or it's supposed to be in the Habitat Division. Things got a little wacky a few years ago when Habitat was pulled out and put back in and rearranged. And I don't think that we're doing everything we need to do in these non-management fisheries research issues, particularly with habitat. I would say that now if we're going to spend a lot of money on particularly on Chinook salmon habitat research or salmon research, we really need some independent panels without user groups to help us figure out what those priorities are and where we should spend this money. I think we could do a lot, particularly in the area of understanding where juvenile fish are and how they might be impacted by our activities. Last thing really could have been a difficult message, that funding the freshwater habitat research needs with the sales of fish licenses is leading, I mean, I said here it can be leading to conflicts of interest. I'm going to go ahead and say that it is leading to conflicts of interest, that the department is funded in large part by selling fishing licenses. It's very hard for them to be critical and take actions that will hinder them from selling those fishing licenses. To their credit, I mean, closing the Kenai River to Chinook early on like that, it is really one of those things. But it's difficult for them to look at those types of research issues that I'm calling for that may have an adverse effect on the ability to go fishing. I hope that was entertaining at the end of the day.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation, Robert. Questions for Robert? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah. I particularly appreciate it. I think your recommendations are insightful and gutsy, whatever the proper term for that is. Is there any way that pike get into new streams and drainage systems without people moving them there?
They can migrate, but primarily we think they're moving by people bringing them in. It's almost impossible to catch them. You know, I mean, we've got very significant penalties if we actually caught them. I don't think we ever caught anybody doing it. In the Kenai River, I think our saving grace, like I told you, that our office is right outside one of these creeks that has pike in it. And the Fish and Wildlife Service, we worked with them. We set a video camera. We actually saw pike swimming from this tributary into the Kenai River. Kenai River's got this glacial component to it. It's too cold, so we just don't think they're doing well. But if by some chance they do well enough and migrate into one of these systems that are really vulnerable, we'll be back here looking at continue operating expenses trying to knock down pike on the Kenai.
Is there anything, when they're in a lake, is there anything you can do? I mean, short of poisoning everything in the lake and starting over?
I'm all for that.
The answer is no, there isn't anything else.
There may be some, I mean, people have talked about research issues and the way they've gone about doing it so far is that they'll remove the non-invasive species out of a lake system and put them in one of the hatcheries, kill the pike, and put them back. And so that seems to be working on the Kenai Peninsula. The next one we've got is this Flowing Water Creek, and that's going to be a lot more difficult for us to kill those pike in that system. But, you know, I know I'm sort of wearing an environmental conservation hat, but I'm not afraid of poisoning these things that need to go away.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Machicki?
Robert, through the chair, I've known you for a long time. And of all the folks that we've heard from today, my evidence through the years is that you can be trusted inherently in what you do. I've seen you bring folks together that, quite frankly, have spent many years saying bad things about each other's mothers. And I've seen you bring those projects to success by bringing folks together that previously would have no interest in doing so. So here's the question. We've got fisheries issues. You are not a member of any of these groups. You have been working for fish, for all of us, for all Alaskans. We've got neighbor versus neighbor, community versus community, region versus region issues because of these fisheries. We will fight for fish in the state. Do you see any solutions on bringing folks together to find a way from the northernmost reaches of the valley to the southernmost reaches of my district that have salmon on working together to solutions, and how would you start?
This must be difficult issue number four or something. Well, Senator Machicki, thank you for the compliment. And we do take it very seriously that, you know, the working together part is really important to do, and it's very difficult. And every 3 years when we go through a board cycle, I don't really like my job that much. I mean, because it really adds a lot of stress to everybody in doing these things. In the arena that I work in, I guess the in the short term, what I see helping is I have some hope that these fish habitat partnerships are going to bring people together around the habitat issues. And it's really hard to separate habitat issues from allocation and passing the fish out. There are blurry lines there. I mean, you can't keep – there's not a clean line there. So I hope that that happens in that regard, that these fish habitat partnerships will mature. And it's allowed me to work a lot more closely with the MATSU in recent years. We'll never get away from arguing over who gets the fish and when and why. It's just a reality. And I think the most important thing we can do is to try to hold the user groups to some level of honesty when they're doing this stuff, which is what you guys are doing here, you know, asking these questions, and keep it as civil as we possibly can.
Follow-up, Senator Machiki?
No, thanks.
No silver bullet, sorry.
I think it was a positive note to end on, however. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. So that's the end of our testimony today. Thank you to everyone who participated today as well as Monday. I think it was very informative, and I appreciate everyone doing that. Our next meeting will be Friday, the 28th. We're going to be, again, 3:30, right? It may go till 5:30. We'll see. We're going to hear an overview of salmon stocks and management plans in the Upper Cook Inlet from the Department of Fish and Game. So at this time, the meeting will adjourn. The time is 5:26 p.m.